The new official view of the American economy, slower than we thought in the winter, a little more lively in the spring.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From APM in New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Midday Update. The test results for the economy are back, and while gross domestic product was revised downward for January to March, it came in at an annualized rate of 1.7% April to June, at a time when many economists were guessing something closer to 1%. Let's go to David Kelly, Chief Global Strategist at J.P. Morgan Funds. Morning, Dr. Kelly.
Good morning.
So first of all, how close was your forecast?
I'm feeling pretty good. I was looking for about 1.3%, so I was a little bit above consensus, and of course it came in above consensus, so that always makes an economist feel pretty good.
Nicely done. So what does this mean, though, higher than expected growth in the spring?
Well, there's not that much to it, really. One of the things that's been pushing this up is we've got higher farm inventories. Apparently, we're headed for a much better harvest this summer than last summer, and that's pushing up farm inventories, and that actually adds to GDP. But outside of that, the economy's only grown by 1.4% over the last year. There's a lot of fiscal drag as the deficit comes down, so it's still pretty slow growth.
Fed policymakers are meeting really any minute now on interest rates and how they want to continue their buying of bonds to stimulate the economy. Is today's stronger than expected growth reading there going to cause any policy swerves?
No, I think it should keep them on their timetable. I mean, if you look at the GDP numbers and also the ADP report that came out this morning and also things on the employment cost index, what we're seeing is an economy which is growing pretty steadily, but it's likely to accelerate in the second half of the year. I don't think there's anything in these numbers that's going to change the Fed's view on that. So overall, we're still headed for an end to quantitative easing, and I think that will gradually push up interest rates, and an improving economy ought to push up earnings and equities.
Economist David Kelly at J.P. Morgan Funds. David, thank you.
Anytime.
Garmin, maker of GPS units, reported today that profits were down more than 7%. Many people use the navigation units on their phones instead, sort of like what smartphones are doing to standalone cameras. Sally Herships has more.
The year 2008 often gets a bad rap, but for GPS, it was glory days. Around 45 million of the devices were sold globally. But this year, GPS sales are expected to be less than half that. That's according to Charlie Anderson, an analyst at Dougherty & Company.
That's lower than Apple sold in terms of total iPhones just in the last 3 months.
Anderson says since smartphones started offering GPS, sales of the standalone GPS devices have declined 15 to 20% a year. Every time a new smartphone rings, a portable GPS dies. Then there's the auto industry. Steve Koenig is with the Consumer Electronics Association. He says built-in navigation in cars is increasingly available and affordable.
Technology has become almost as important as miles per gallon when it comes to buying a new car these days.
But Charlie Anderson says Garmin hasn't lost its way. It's diversified, selling GPS watches for runners and navigation systems for boats and planes. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
The Senate did it first, but the final vote should come in the House of Representatives today to force the interest rate on federally subsidized student loans back down to near where they were just a month ago. The rate will now be set by the market, but with caps in case rates someday go wild. For students, the key piece of data is this. New federally subsidized borrowing for undergrads this fall will be 3.9%, just above where it used to be. Angus King, the independent senator from Maine, supported this compromise. Morning, Senator.
Good morning, David. How are you?
Good. So congratulations. You and your colleagues have fixed the problem of the high cost of higher education.
Well, yeah, would that we had, but we've fixed at least a little bit of a piece of it in terms of the student loan program, which was fixed at 6.8%, which is way above where the market is now. So students are overpaying next year to the tune of about $10 billion if we hadn't been able to do something. And I think we came up with a good piece of policy, but perhaps as importantly, a good process where this was the result of bipartisan negotiations instead of the usual gridlock around here.
And in a way, when the government subsidizes student loans, in a way, it's subsidizing the colleges and the universities, right?
Well, I made that point particularly with Pell Grants. You know, we can find a little extra money and give everybody an extra $1,000 on their Pell Grants, and the college raises their cost by $1,000. You know, the students don't win, the government doesn't win, the taxpayers don't win. I guess the colleges do. It's a sort of economics question. Are we throwing more dollars at a finite amount of goods? And Economics 101 tells you when that happens, the price is going to go up.
Now, you can blame our friends in higher ed for a lot of this, but maybe it's us. Maybe it's our kids. When they shop for colleges, they want fancy gyms, spiffy student center, technology galore, and that makes colleges more expensive.
You're absolutely right. I have a friend who's the president of a college, and he calls it the arms race. And, you know, the students are saying, well, now, how good is your food? I don't know about you, David, but it never occurred to me to check out the food at the college where I was going to go. And they all knew have to have gyms and workout rooms and climbing walls and turf fields and all that kind of thing. And colleges have now become essentially the richest environment any of us will ever live in our lives in terms of, you know, the amenities that are around us.
But you're not sure if public policy has a role in thinking about what to do next?
I do think there are some things that we might be able to do. For example, by saying if you're going to take all of this federal money, whether it's loans or Pell Grants from these students, we think there should be some accountability in terms of how many of your students graduate, how many of your students find jobs. I'm not sure what the federal role is except to shine a light on this question, because otherwise all we're doing is throwing money and it doesn't benefit the students. In fact, it disbenefits the students if they have to take out these huge loans and the price goes up in proportion to the availability of the loans or the grants.
Now, here's a truly awful advertising line that would go nowhere on Madison Avenue. We make driving boring again, or we make smartphones boring again. Is it possible that what Wall Street needs is this slogan, "We make banking boring again"? I also talked to Senator Angus King of Maine, who's been working with some prominent Democrats and Republicans, on bringing some boredom to banking 5 years after the great financial collapse. Senator, you're worried this could happen again?
Yeah, I am. And I think there are a couple of threads left unattended to in the actions that took place. The major reaction to the financial was Dodd-Frank.
That was, of course, the financial reform law passed in 2009 that got at some of this.
Right. But it's essentially a regulatory solution. It's, you know, let's pass regulations. And by the way, a lot of the regulations, David, I got to tell you, are having a negative impact without any corresponding public benefit, particularly at smaller banks. So I've co-sponsored, along with an unlikely group, Elizabeth Warren, John McCain, Angus King, and Maria Cantwell from Washington, the 21st Century Glass-Steagall Act, which fundamentally separates investment banking and hedge funds and that kind of activity from regular commercial banking. This was the law in the country for 70 years, from 1933, and then it started to get whittled down by the Fed, and then finally was repealed in 1999. And I just think it was a fundamental mistake.
But of course, it would have the effect of breaking up some of these big banks, do the investment banking part, trading on your own account part.
Yeah.
But if you want to be a bank that takes depositors' money, you think that should be a different company.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm not arguing it was the sole problem in 2008. But I think looking forward, it's just inevitable that you have this sort of built-in conflict where your deposits are insured and then you've got the whole too-big-to-fail thing. Somebody said our goal is to make banking boring again.
Yeah, some people call it narrow banking. But bringing back Depression-era distinction seems a little retro.
Well, hey, Mark Twain once said, history doesn't always repeat itself, but it usually rhymes. You know, the real problem, David, is that so many innocent people are hurt by this. I mean, there are thousands of people in Maine who still are out of work because of decisions made on Wall Street and Washington and, you know, the big cities. And that's just not fair. And it seems to me I don't see any downside to this, frankly. And
I mean, it's going to be a challenge. Powerful financial services companies are not going to take this lying down. They're going to say, we're making profits again. It's okay. They paid back the bailout money. Why are you picking on us?
No, I think they're going to come into town and say, Angus, you've got a great idea. You and Elizabeth and John McCain, we're for you. You know, I don't think
if that happens,
I have a bridge to sell you. No, it will be, of course. And, you know, when we first proposed it, I thought, well, OK, this is a good idea. But we've gotten a lot of support. I think the public understands this and thinks it's a good idea. I think it's got a lot more political oomph to it than I would have said even 2 weeks ago.
Angus King, independent from Maine. Senator King, thank you very much.
Great to be with you, David, as always.
And an astrophysicist has been pondering one of the great questions. What is the best order to board an airplane? Dr. Jason Steffen of the University of Illinois thinks he has a better way. After careful consideration and the application of the sort of math available to physicists, he says fill the window seats first. Uh-huh. But also space the passengers two rows apart as they go aboard. The system requires a list of people to board precisely in order, which in the real world is unlikely. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.